My name is Lily Kieber. I'm the director and producer of Bayou Maharaja, The Tragic Genius of James Booker, and I'm glad to be here today.
So when was it that you first started to think of making this film?
The first time I ever heard James Booker was down at Vaughn's Lounge. I was bartending there, and during the daytime, you know, it gets slow, so I'd play the jukebox, and he was one of those guys on the jukebox. But probably of everything on there, he was the one that made the least amount of sense to me. Just like, what is the sound coming out of the box? What are these stories people are telling? You know, the whole thing just seemed a mystery. And then when I'd go to Google him or try to find out more, read books or whatever, you know, there just wasn't a lot out there. So it made it more mysterious, but this, you know, more intriguing too.
Given the scarcity of material about Booker, what was the process of putting the film together like?
Well, I didn't know a lot about Booker, and I didn't know a ton about New Orleans music. You know, I knew all the main things, of course, but, you know, I don't have a degree in music history, nor am I from here. So I started out asking people that I thought would know something, honestly, and I had to ask really basic questions also because I didn't know a lot. So I talked to Cosimo Matassa, I talked to Bunny Matthews, I talked to David Kunyon, of course. You know, he's a font of knowledge on all things New Orleans. And, you know, it's just one person led me to another. And because James Booker is so complicated, you know, and such a multifaceted character, I always knew I wanted to interview as many people as possible to try to get the full picture. I mean, it's also hard making a film about someone I never met. You know, I don't have any opinions on him. And maybe that's for the best, so I could be a little more objective or listen with open ears to what everyone was saying. Because people really did see him differently.
And were there any bits of information you discovered that particularly surprised you?
Oh, everything. Well, I mean, when I started out, you know, I was attracted to Booker because I had an emotional connection with the music, you know, not because I'm a musician or because I had, you know, because I knew technical stuff. When I started out, I really didn't know that he was such a unique and distinct and learned pianist. You know, I really had to learn that along the way. And, you know, I mean, I'll be forever grateful to all the, you know, piano players who sat down and explained in really basic terms, like, okay, this is what he's doing on the left hand, and this is what he's doing on the right hand, and this is the reference he's making in the middle of the song, you know, because it's such dense material, and I really had to have people break it down for me. I mean, audiences always say that that's one of the things that they take away from the film most, is that part where Harry Connick Jr. breaks down Sunny Side of the Street. It opens audiences' ears to what's going on with Booker. For one, he makes it sound so easy. You know, it just flows, and it's like velvet. I don't know, it's like a chocolate milkshake. It just goes down smooth. But it's deceptively smooth. You know, there is just so much in there, and I mean, bless their hearts. You know, it's like every year when we have the Booker tribute, I think that's when I really see the most, like, just how complicated his music is, because I see piano players who are totally monsters on their instrument get up there and play Booker, and like they break a sweat midway through the song, and they're like, you know, having to put so much effort into it because it's, you know, again, it's such complex music. And in a lot of ways, I think it's even more, you know, it's harder to play than something like Beethoven because it's not written down. And because, you know, it's just not just the notes, it's the soul.
And of course, there are many people who are great or interesting musicians, but whose life stories might not necessarily make a good documentary. What was it about James Booker's life that you thought would be compelling as a story?
Well, everything. I mean, I think that there's nothing about Booker's life that was easy or straightforward. You know, to be African American in those times of segregation, to be gay, to be bipolar, you know, to be one-eyed. I mean, of course, you know, there's a zillion stories about Booker's, you know, drug use and the crazy things he would do on stage. But it's also like, I mean, it must have been hard to walk in that man's shoes. The biggest pushback I got with the film was the fact that I talk about him being gay. It's like, I mean, it's 2013, you know? Aren't people past this yet? The guy's been dead for 30 years and people still, like, can't decide how they feel about him.
Was it known during his lifetime that he was gay, publicly?
It was known by his friends. You know, it was known by people who worked with him. You can hear stuff that he says. I mean, he talks all the time about being in love with Burt Reynolds. So, I mean, you can listen to some of the rants and, you know, pick stuff up, yeah. And I do talk about it directly in the film. Like, no one's going to walk away from this film and wonder.
Of course. Was there any footage of Booker that you uncovered for the film?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I found a lot of concert footage. I found some, I went to Germany, and a guy gave me two Super 8 films that he did of Booker in East Germany, and they're fascinating. They don't have sound, but still, just like watching him play, and especially the thought of, you know, this is behind the Iron Curtain, but I mean, the audience are just enraptured. It's beautiful. And then I found a 90-minute home movie of Booker, and like from Germany. And the first half of it is him playing, and the second half of him is just sitting and talking. And it's probably the most bizarre thing I've ever seen in my life. I actually find it really hard to watch all the way through. It's like watching someone else's acid trip. You know, just like what those camera guys are doing and the effects they're using, and it's just the weirdest thing I've ever seen. But of course it's the weirdest thing I've ever seen. It's James Booker, you know, like and the audio quality is weird and the visual quality is weird, but just like everything that has to do with this film is a little different. You know, and neither of those had ever been seen by anyone in the world, as far as I know. And then there's some other concert footage that I uncovered. One show from Baton Rouge that had been broadcast, but it's not commercially available. I didn't know of anyone who had ever seen it. When I started out, that was one of the first things that that people would say. I don't know why you would ever say this to a filmmaker, but you know, people, oh, you're never going to find footage of them. You know, just nothing exists. You know, thanks a lot, guys. thanks for that encouragement. You know, but it really is one of my hopes with the film is that once it's released, you know, more of this stuff will be pulled out of attics and that more of it, you know, will come to the surface. And hopefully that the people who own it, you know, will allow it to be released. I mean, that's been a real struggle as well. But, I mean, I just feel like he's too great a resource, not only for New Orleans, but for America, you know. And it's just, it does an injustice to everyone to have this stuff, you know, locked up in an attic.
How do you go about finding a bit of footage, like the bit you mentioned from the guy in Germany?
You ask someone who asks someone else to ask someone else. You know, that's, I mean, I'm not a researcher. You know, all I know how to do is talk to people. James Booker means so much to people that when I said I wanted to make this film, you know, people have really, they've been so generous with everything. I find that when, if people know who James Booker is, you know, the two things that they know about him is that he's one of the best piano players to ever come out of New Orleans, or America, I'd say, and also that he's totally unknown, you know, so people would understand why I was making the film. And, you know, they would know that clearly I'm not in it for the money, because there is none, you know, but just for the love of James Booker, people would go through their attics, talk to their friends, send out emails, you know, really go out of their way. And for that, I'll be forever grateful. So
you've just returned recently from South by Southwest, which was the
World premiere
of the film. Can you tell me a bit about the festival?
In making the film, we always wanted to go for South by Southwest. You know, it's just known for being a music-friendly festival, obviously. And also geographically, you know, I think Austin audiences get New Orleans maybe a little more than audiences in the rest of the country. You know, and it's just known for being funky and for being independent. And we just felt like it would find a good home there. So we were, you know, super enthusiastic when they accepted our film. We were still totally at a rough cut. It was exciting to be accepted. And then I was like, oh no, now I have to finish this thing. So it was a solid month of 16-hour days editing, you know, having three or four of us working 16-hour days. Of course, in the midst of that was the Super Bowl and Mardi Gras. And, you know, my editor's in a marching band, of course, because it's New Orleans. So it was probably, yeah, the most challenging month of my life. But at the end of it, you know, I have a film that I feel really great about. So we went to Austin, and I mean, they did have a, you know, pretty full roster of music films, but I have to say, when we got really great press, the Hollywood Reporter called us the number one must-see movie film of South by Southwest. And actually, we made number one on a couple of lists, you know, which is encouraging, of course. I mean, after working on this thing alone, kind of in my own little vacuum for so long, there's always that question with New Orleans, like, are people going to care? Is it going to translate, you know, this culture that we love so much? I mean, the rest of the country doesn't really know about, or doesn't care, or doesn't see it as, you know, as special as we do. And James Booker is right there. So it was really encouraging, and it's been encouraging with the reviews that people have picked up on some of the themes that I have in the film. You know, this, the question of the, you know, the intersection of art and industry.
I was curious, at what point in James Booker's life does video footage of him start to become available?
The first video I have of James Booker is from a Dr. John concert in 73, and he's got the eye patch. And, you know, it kind of breaks my heart because, like, all through the 60s, he played with, you know, everyone in creation. He was such a renowned sideman. And I don't have any pictures, and I don't have any video of any of that. You know, it's a real regret that I have in the film is that sort of the 60s are glossed over because I just don't have that material. So the first time we see Booker in video is in Dr. John's band. But then it really picks up when he goes to Europe for the first time. So from the mid to late 70s, that's where the bulk of the concert footage comes from, because when James Booker went to Europe, suddenly he found an audience who could appreciate, you know, the level that he was playing at, maybe because they're more, you know, attuned to, they have more classical training and more classical ears. Europeans could, you know, pick up on the fact that he was taking these classical techniques and applying them to R&B and, you know, street rhythms and all that. And they were so amazed by it that they recorded him. So, you know, it's definitely something that I, as a documentarian living in New Orleans, have had to think about. You know, it's like right now we're surrounded by great music, but when was the last time I went out and recorded someone live? You know, I'm always pulling out my hair trying to find more footage of Booker from New Orleans. But it's like, at the same time, it is up to us today to also go out and document our musicians and love our musicians and pay our musicians, you know. These same themes that Booker suffered through, I mean, do apply today. You know, I always talk about the mental health issue. You know, like, maybe if there had been more services for his mental health and addiction, maybe Booker would have survived. But at the same time, you know, Jindal today is cutting back the mental health services. You know, today charity doesn't exist. So, you know, it's wonderful that the Musicians Clinic is here for musicians. But at the same time, like, you know, they're still having to do bake sales. You know, I think that the atmosphere has gotten better, but I still don't think that, like, that our musicians and our creative people today have, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe it's not much better today than it was in the 70s or 1983 when he died.
Did Booker ever seek out professional help for his mental problems during his life?
He would go to the third floor of Charity Hospital. You know, when his mental state really started to get iffy, he would check into Charity Hospital and cool out for a while. And there's many stories of him just sitting there and playing piano. Maybe the keyboard was the only place in the world, or certainly in his reality, where he had control over it. And for us, you know, we're lucky that he did, because, you know, we're lucky that we have those recordings. But so he would go to the, you know, Charity Hospital for his mental for his mental unhealth. And then, you know, sometimes his physical state would get so bad he'd have to check into a hospital as well. But as far as I know, I mean, that's the extent of the mental services that I know of back then. But of course I wasn't around, so I don't know.
Were there any interviews you did for the film that really surprised you? Like, wow, never thought I'd be talking to this person about James Booker.
Well, probably Hugh Laurie was the most surprising choice for an interview. I mean, of course, I loved interviewing Dr. John and Alan Toussaint and Irma Thomas. I mean, these are heroes to me. You know, these are the people I care most about in the world. Like, you know, and then when Hugh Laurie came out with that album of New Orleans music, and the title track is "Let Them Talk," you know, which for him was a reference to Booker. It's like, oh. Who knew that Hugh Laurie was a Booker fan? And there were, you know, there's always been a lot of those. I've gotten emails from so many people across the world that you never would have expected to love Booker. George Winston is another one. You know, listening to his piano playing, one wouldn't necessarily expect him to be such a New Orleans piano fanatic. But again, I mean, this stuff is important stuff. You know, it's obviously we as New Orleanians love, you know, this music, but it really is important in the formation of musical history. So yeah, interviewing Hugh Laurie was, I think, also the interesting thing or the fun thing about interviewing him, and really about interviewing a lot of people, is that they're so reverential of Booker that they, like, kind of get like little kids or shy. And certainly interviewing Harry Connick Sr., you know, who knew Booker as a kid, he totally turns into a child on screen. You can see him reliving those memories. And like, there's a great part that I used in the film where he's where Harry Connick Jr. is remembering James Booker coming to the house. And like, he talks about opening the door and there's Booker and he's wearing a suit, you know, and he's trying to clean up his act. And you can just see Harry on camera. You can just see him reliving that moment. And it's something that a lot of the audiences talk about, is you can just feel that love that he has for him. It's also kind of funny now because piano players, like, I'll walk into a room and they'll stop playing because they think that I'm some sort of piano expert because I asked them about Booker. I mean, guys, I still don't know anything about music. I still don't even know where middle C is, but I don't know. On the other hand, listening to Booker has probably ruined my ears for piano playing. Actually, that's kind of true. You know, because who can top him?
Indeed. Well, Lily, thanks for coming by. Cool. And good luck with the film.
Thank you.